I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up on The Story, our series After Innocence. Jason Perocal spent 9 months in a crowded Nicaraguan prison waiting for his day in court to prove that the charges of drug running and money laundering against him were false. He was convinced that he'd be set free once the judge had a chance to hear how hollow the charges were. But the presiding judge was clearly not someone who was willing to listen.
Every objection they had, he would rule in their favor. The defense was not allowed to present any evidence. I was not allowed to present any documentation. My accountant was ruled irrelevant. Witnesses were ruled irrelevant. It's just absurd. I wasn't able – they basically just pointed the finger at me, and you couldn't say anything against it. You just had to accept what it was.
Jason's sentence was 22 years. It was up to his family and friends to prove that he wasn't a criminal. After Innocence with Jason and Janice Perocal, after the news.
This podcast is made possible by listeners who can contribute now at thestory.org and in collaboration by Burt's Bees, Red Hat, and the Redwoods Group Foundation, who believe by working together we can help strengthen communities for a better world.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And this is our series After Innocence, Exoneration in America.
I realized that I was going to be executed for crimes I didn't commit.
A Summit County judge today ruling that DNA evidence backs what Prade has always said. He is innocent of the murder of his wife.
I was on a mission. I have to help them find this guy because he's out there. He will rape
After
other people.
After spending 32 years behind bars, a man convicted of killing a rantoul toddler is out of jail.
No physical evidence, no eyewitnesses, nothing. It was just a fantasy.
I'm telling him I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it.
Today we'll hear the story of a man who won exoneration, not from an American prison, but from one in Nicaragua. Jason Perocal was serving a lengthy sentence there, while his sister Janice built a campaign to set him free, getting everyone from politicians to diplomats to CNN to pay attention and to report on conditions in the prison.
It's one of the most dangerous prisons in the world, Nicaragua's infamous La Modelo. And an American who just about everyone says is innocent has been here for 18 months, serving a sentence of 22 years. His name is Jason Perocal, and he's living a nightmare.
The National Registry of Exonerations lists over 1,000 men and women here in the U.S. who've been able to prove their innocence. There are many thousand more Americans locked away in foreign prisons. And many of them insist they're also innocent, but battling in foreign courts is an expensive and exhausting pursuit. Ask Jason and Janice Perocal. She was a lawyer in Seattle. He had a real estate business on the beach in Nicaragua. He was selling vacation homes to North Americans and Europeans.
I'd been there since 2002 with the Peace Corps and then in San Juan del Sur since 2004. And so my arrest in 2010 was, you know, I had a good 6 years in one spot and had definitely integrated with the community, knew the mayors, had sold property for the mayors, for the police. We helped get the police from 3 police up to 20 police with this Amigos de Policía program. We had integrated with the church and were helping with the schools and the church to get them more materials for the kids that are required to have a notebook and a pencil. Just constantly across the board. And my wife, of course, being Nicaraguan, she was actually doing her internship as she was in law school with the prosecutor's office in San Juan del Sur at the time. So definitely we thought that we were very integrated.
And so it was a huge shock to Jason on November 11th, 2010, when the police stormed his home and business.
It was 8 or 10 guys with full black Kevlar masks, AKs. I thought I was being robbed. They didn't identify themselves as police when they initially stormed my office. And so it was very scary. And, you know, eventually they said that they were police, but they wouldn't let me talk to my attorney. They wouldn't let me call my family. They wouldn't tell me why I was there or why they were there and what they were looking for. While they held me for 8 hours in my office, they at the same time stormed my house. And my mother, who's a physician in Tacoma, Washington, was visiting. They stormed the house while she was there with my son. My wife came home and found this situation and kept them at gunpoint for 6 hours as well. And so, no, it was terrifying.
And straight from there to jail or to prison for
straight
you?
Straight to jail, and then within the first week, they moved me around to four different prisons, hiding me from my family, my attorneys, and the embassy.
Janice, where were you when all this was happening?
I was at home in Seattle, Washington. So the way that I heard about this was our mother called and said, they've taken your brother. The police have taken him. They won't tell us where he is. You have to do something.
She was down there, so what did you do? I mean, she didn't know anything, so you knew even less.
Exactly, and nobody knew what was going on, but we all thought it was just a big mistake. We all thought that the prosecutor would get involved, realize that the police had picked up the wrong guy, they would let him go, it wouldn't be a big deal. So it was just my job to call the embassy and be in constant contact with the embassy to figure out, okay, how can we get this resolved and get Jason back? We tried initially to do that. It basically went nowhere. And then 3 days later, Jason was formally charged.
And were you in Nicaragua at the time?
Not when he was charged. He was charged on a Sunday evening, 3 days after the arrest. And on Monday morning, I jumped the first flight to Nicaragua, and my sister and I headed down there and immediately started moving from prison to prison trying to find Jason. And we were just tracking him all over the country.
You didn't even know where he was at the time?
No.
And couldn't find out where he was?
No, and nobody would tell us what was going on or why they were holding him, where they were holding him. We couldn't get even the embassy to get information.
And were you thinking at the time, you know, is this really the justice system of the country or is this some kind of kidnapping?
No, I was thinking, okay, this is a mistake that it's gotten bigger. But if I can just talk to the prosecutor and make them understand that they've got the wrong guy, then I can fix this and we can all go home. So I fully expected, and I remember having a conversation with my sister on the plane down there going, okay, we're going to fix this. We're going to bring Jason home and we'll bring Jabu and his son and his wife and we'll treat them to a big dinner and a spa day and everything will be fine.
And how long did it take you to even find him?
It took us a week before we found him.
And Jason, you had no opportunity to phone anybody or to tell anyone your side of the story?
It wasn't until after a week that I was able to get an underground cell phone.
Somebody's smuggled phone, right?
Exactly. And that's when I was able to contact my sisters and my wife through my wife. And that's how they found me eventually. So it wasn't ever through any formal communication from the prisons or the police or the prosecution to my family or attorneys at all.
We actually filed motions with the court and tried to get judges involved to find out where Jason was, and they still couldn't give us any information.
Do you remember that phone call when you finally heard Jason's voice?
Yeah, I do. We were at his house in San Juan, and we were all sitting around there trying to decide what to do for the next day. And then the phone rang, and it was Jason on the other end. And again, I thought, okay, now he's gotten a phone, so that means he's out, and he's just waiting for us to go pick him up.
What did he say to you?
I remember he sounded very depressed, and he sounded he had kind of a hushed voice, and he said, hey, it's me. And that's when we all kind of froze up, like, oh, my God, it's Jason on the phone. And then he said that he was still in prison. And so at that point, he was giving us instructions about what he needed because he hadn't had food and he had no water. So he was just giving us a list of, you know, I need these things. I need you to bring these things to me. And then I need you to go to the office and find these different documents. You have to explain this to the prosecutor. And here's all the documents as far as showing that this is a legitimate real estate business.
Oh, they figured at that point that your real estate business was some kind of front for money laundering, drug running, that sort of thing?
That's what they, that's the story that they were telling.
So at least they told you that much at that point, right?
Yes. At the accusation, they said that they had charged me with international drug trafficking without 1 gram of drugs in the case. They charged me with money laundering with, again, no illicit funds. And they charged me with organized crime with 10 people I didn't know. And so the documents that I was explaining to my sister were, you need to go and get the corporate documents from the office. You need to get the banking records, et cetera, et cetera. And who's my accountant. Here's my attorney for the law office so that who's done all the transactions so that she can put together the case to present to the prosecutor saying there's been a mistake.
Did you think that that would fix it, that you'd be out in a few days once you'd managed to contact family?
Yes, I I imagine that, again, just like Jan said, that this was just a huge misunderstanding. I couldn't fathom why I was being targeted. And I just imagined that, you know, as soon as somebody that I know contacts somebody else higher up in the chain of command, this will all just get resolved.
Well, Janice, you're a lawyer, so you know your way around justice systems. I mean, this was a different country, and you're part of the bar in Washington. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, I'm a civil lawyer in Washington, so I deal with contracts and businesses and corporations and appeals and that sort of thing.
You at least understand the language a little
bit. I understand the language of the law, but this was not even based in law. What was going on in Nicaragua had no basis in the law whatsoever. From my perspective as a lawyer...
Not even Nicaraguan law.
Not even Nicaraguan law,
exactly. Not international law, not Nicaraguan law.
Exactly.
Not any law.
Yeah. And from my perspective as a lawyer, I was looking at this going, don't they have to have probable cause to make an arrest? You know, where's their probable cause? Where's the warrant? And that's what I started. I approached the case from that angle of, you know, where are all these different criteria and how can we attack this on a legal basis? And I very quickly figured out that this has nothing to do with the law and we had to come up with a different strategy to attack this.
How much time did you have between Jason's getting charged and Jason's getting convicted for these crimes that he was accused of?
We were doing everything we could to try and get this before a judge at trial, to get a judge to step in here and go, okay, everybody has screwed up, let Jason go. And the prosecution repeatedly moved for continuances of the trial date. And they would move for a continuance but not tell the defense. So our entire defense team would show up for trial on the first day and find out that the trial had been continued. And this went on for 9 months before we could even get the case to trial.
Tell me about the day in court, though. Both of you, what you recall.
The trial itself was actually 6 days.
But it was just a circus. The so-called judge that they put in place, my sisters and my wife found out and got actual documentation from the Supreme Court that this gentleman was not a judge and he was not even a registered attorney in Nicaragua. And it came out actually 2 days before trial that he was actually wanted by the police for fraud in another part of the country.
But he still sat as the judge in your case.
This is the first and only time that he sat as a judge in Nicaragua. And as soon as the trial was over, he fled the country to Spain. And it was so obvious that he was in favor of the prosecution. Every objection they had, he would rule in their favor. The defense was not allowed to present any evidence. I was not allowed to present any documentation. My accountant was ruled irrelevant. Witnesses were ruled irrelevant. It's just absurd. I wasn't able – they basically just pointed the finger at me and you couldn't say anything against it. You just had to accept what it was.
So take me back to the time when your sentence was handed down.
That was – so basically after the end of trial, the judge took a 15-minute recess after closing arguments and came back and convicted all 11 defendants. No reasons, nothing. Just everyone's convicted.
And Jason's sentence was to be –
And Jason's sentence was 22 years.
Once Jason Puracal went to prison, it was going to be even harder for his sister Janice and others to work through the system to prove his innocence. They did it, and we'll hear how in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We're continuing our series, After Innocence, and following the story of Jason and Janice Puracal. He spent 9 months in a Nicaragua prison, falsely accused of being part of a drug cartel. He and his sister felt that once the case went to trial, he'd be free within a day.
We had actually started that day making signs for Jason, welcome home signs for Jason, because we thought he was coming home. And then they called and said, he was convicted. Everyone was. And it's done. And now he's back at the prison, so you can't talk to him. And that was it for us. It was just tears everywhere.
You'd already spent 9 months in that prison. You had a really good idea what you were going back to, what it was like. Tell me where you were staying.
So the prison that, again, they had moved me around to four different prisons, and one of them was El Chapote, which is basically a torture chamber. It was the Somoza regime, their torture chamber, which is basically hell. And it's an underground facility.
So no windows.
No windows, no light. And then I was moved from there to La Modelo, which is the maximum security prison in Nicaragua. And it's infamous for human rights violations. They don't let human rights organizations in there to inspect. They don't let anybody in there to inspect. It's overcrowded. I was in a 12 by 15 foot cell with anywhere from 9 to 12 guys.
Were there beds in there?
In some of the cells, you could get cots if you could buy from somebody else. But most of the time, for about half the time that I was in prison, I was on a concrete floor. And some people had hammocks that they would tie to the bars. But you're just basically one on top of the other. And then there's a small, in that same size of 12 by 15, there's a 6 foot by 3 foot area that has a hole in the ground that is where you do your bathing, you wash your dishes, you brush your teeth. Everything is done in that little bathroom area for all nine guys.
And that's where the toilet is too?
That's what the toilet is, just a hole in the ground. And there's no running water. So you every morning at 5:30, you got to haul your two buckets of water. And every afternoon at 4:30, you got to do the same thing. And so, you know, it's just – that's a huge fight just in itself, just trying to get water every morning.
Do you have anything with you, like pen, paper, books, magazines?
My sisters would bring in books for me to read. Initially, they weren't allowing me in to have books. You could only have one Bible in. And then because of the language barrier, they allowed me to start having English books in. And so I spent most of my time reading. I ended up reading over 200 books while I was in prison.
How did the other prisoners treat you?
It's a very delicate situation. You're in there with murderers, rapists,
real drug dealers.
Yeah. And there's a lot of tension between the different groups in there. And so you really have to watch your back all the time. And one person that may be your friend today will easily take advantage of you the next day. And so it's just a fine line you have to walk there.
Give me an example of an experience that you recall from that prison that illustrates that, if you can.
Well, in the first week that we were in La Modelo, I was in a cell, and it was actually the first cells that we were put in, me and the other people in my case, were the cells where they send – it was a cell block where they send the worst offenders in the prison. So like the punishment cells where there's no electricity. You're in smaller chambers actually. And the prisoners on either side of the cells, they knock out holes in the wall, just a small little square so that they can pass things back and forth. And that's how we had gotten the illicit cell phone so that I was able to call my sisters. And those guys on the first day that we came in, you know, gave us food to eat, gave us a blanket to lie down on the floor with. And as soon as we got packages from our family and we went out for the next visit, they took everything. Through those little holes, they managed to pull every single thing down to the toothbrush out of that cell with little grappling hooks tied with plastic bags that they had created. The only thing that they left were the books in English. So, so just things like that. I was constantly robbed. I was assaulted several times.
Just beaten?
Yeah, people would just start fighting with you for no reason at all. You know, you walk outside your cell and some guy is standing there and he just wants to pick a fight with you. And being a foreigner there, some of the locals think that you have money. And so they're constantly testing you to see how much they can get out of you. My sisters would come in. They'd either steal it or I'd have to share it with everybody that was in the cell.
And otherwise, what was the prison food? What were they feeding you there?
They give you rice and beans three times a day. And it's mixed up with a sodium bicarbonate, so to make the prisoners feel full. So it's definitely not a balanced, healthy diet.
It actually led to major digestive problems that landed Jason in emergency.
In the hospital. Yeah, they took me to the hospital. Eventually, for a week, I couldn't even stand up on my own. Other prisoners had to carry me to the prison medical ward. And after the second day, the doctor said, oh, you need to go to the hospital and have surgery. And the prison warden, the director, said, nope, this is a special case. He's not leaving.
And all this time, Janice, you're barely in touch with Jason, right?
Well, he would get access to that cell phone. And so that was how I was able to know exactly what he was going through. There was a point where my sister and I went to visit him and brought him bags of food. And he was struggling to pick up the bags just to take them back to his cell.
Janice, what was the low point for you in all this?
There were a lot of low points. There were a lot of days where I would think, I think most on days I'd wake up and go, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I am just banging my head against the wall and I'm going to be doing this for 22 years before he gets out. So I don't know if I can pinpoint, you know, which one was the lowest point. I know the worst day of my life was the day that Jason was burned in prison. He was, and I'll let Jason tell the story because he can tell it a lot better than I can.
So as I mentioned, they don't have running water in the cells. There's one pipe that comes in that everybody takes their water from in buckets. Well, the water that comes out of that pipe has got hair and dirt and dead insects or live insects floating in it. So it's not potable. So in an effort to try to get some potable water, we would sometimes try to boil water in a pot on a little hot plate stove connected to two wires that hang out of the wall. And the wires are all spliced together and running through the mattresses, so fire hazards are a huge ordeal. Anyway, so I was trying to boil water one day in the cell, and I was alone in the cell, and I had this big pot of water. And I was lifting the pot up, and there's no pot holder, so we had two pieces of shirt that we were taking using for the pot holders, and the pot slipped out of my hands and it fell on the table and spilled towards me, and the water ran and hit my thighs and burned me all the way down to my feet. And so I have still big scars on my thighs, and you can see on the tops of my feet here that I just had skin missing. And immediately I went and told the guards, and they took me to the prison medic ward, and they gave me some cream and sent me back to the cell.
And, you had the really serious burns.
Yeah. They were second and third degree.
The pain must
bombs.
Have been unbelievable.
Yeah. As soon as I got back to the cell, I immediately got a hold of an illicit cell phone and called Janice.
And that was the worst moment for me of the entire case, when Jason called. I had come to expect his phone calls at a certain time during the day because it was after the guards would leave. And this call came early, and so I picked up the phone and I said, "Why are you calling me so early? Did the guards leave early or something?" And he said, "There's been an accident. I've been hurt." And then he just started crying. And so I knew that he was in tremendous pain. This is my big brother crying to me on the phone. I knew it was really bad. And after I got the story from him, I hung up and I was in my office and I was just bawling. And pulled myself together, called immediately the embassy, the congressman, my mother, my sister, everyone that we could think of, and we were just basically a phone tree of who could get to Jason. And the problem was that the prison was telling the embassy that, no, these are just first-degree burns, there are no blisters, Jason's fine. But I had Jason on the phone describing the burns to me, and I knew that they were much worse than first degree. I knew they were at least second degree, if not worse. And I couldn't get the embassy to actually go to the prison to check on him. I had a doctor on standby waiting outside the prison to let him in, and they wouldn't let him in. And so instead, we flew my mother down.
Your mother's a doctor,
My mother's
right?
a doctor, yeah. Exactly. So we put her on a plane, we flew her down, and she reported back to me that the first time she saw Jason, his bandages were soaked through with blood, and an infection had started in one of his legs that could have led to sepsis. So she got him bandages and antibiotics and taught him how to bandage himself and how to clean his own wounds so that he wouldn't lose his legs.
And you had to do this yourself in prison.
Yeah. The prison doctor basically said, you know, just don't wash the wounds with the prison water.
Because it's infected.
Because it's infected. So try to keep it dry and use this cream. And that was basically it. And then the reason I got infected, we think, is because they were using a needle to pop the blisters, which they told the embassy that didn't exist. And I found out the second day when I went back to get more blisters popped that they don't have clean needles.
And so they were using dirty needles to pop these blisters.
You're listening to The Story and our series After Innocence. Jason Perucal had been wrongfully convicted and locked away in a prison in Nicaragua. His sister Janice led the effort to get him out, marshaling support from every conceivable corner. U.S. Congress, the media, anywhere she could find it. Jason didn't know much about that. He was pinning his hopes on the appeal, which came 2 years after he was locked away.
They had moved me out of general population and into a solitary confinement. And they were giving me one. At that time, I had, because I was in solitary confinement, no access to an illicit cell phone. But the guards, I had figured out that by Nicaraguan law or prison law, that they're supposed to give me a 15-minute phone call every 15 days. And so I started enacting that through the embassy, got them to put pressure on the warden to give me that right. And so I'd call Janice for 15 minutes every 15 days. And so it just so happened on the day that I went out to go make a phone call to Janice, one of the guards comes in and he has a newspaper. And on the top of the front page, it says, Perucal va libre, Perucal goes free. And so I looked at it and said, sweet. And I turned around to walk out the door. And, you know, he goes, no, wait, you can't leave yet. So I knew immediately then, and I picked up the phone and called Janice. She says, have you heard? And I said, yeah, I just saw the paper.
Oh, so you weren't there at the time?
No.
You got the news in Washington?
I got the news in Seattle, exactly. So we were just waiting for this phone call with Jason to be able to tell him.
Who was with you when the call came through?
My sister. The two of us were there just jumping up and down in the kitchen, just waiting on pins and needles to be able to tell Jason that, okay, we've got the order, you're coming home. Yeah. We just have to get you.
I wonder, though, if at that point you were, either one of you, really confident that it was all over, because there was such a sort of cartoon of justice through this whole thing that it'd be like, oh, get me on a plane out of Nicaragua, and then I'll believe I'm free.
Well, the thing is, in Nicaragua, so the court can issue you, they call it a carta de libertad, a letter of freedom. And there's guys that are sitting in prison that have had that letter for over a year.
Oh, don't tell me this.
And still waiting to be released. And so we didn't know when I was actually. So my phone call with Janice, she was like, yes, we got the results from the court. Now I'm trying to mobilize everybody to get you out. So she said, I don't know when it's going to be, but we're pushing for as soon as possible.
How did it come about?
It actually came the day after.
The second
day,
correct.
Within 2 days of getting that letter. So,
and there were cameras and everything parked outside the prison. And so there was a lot of pressure.
And that's when you two got together for the first time?
When he flew into New York, we saw him for the first time. And our whole family was out there waiting for him.
At the airport.
That must have been amazing for both of you.
What
do you remember of that?
Hugging my son and him just calling me Papa. Like, he recognized me immediately. I wasn't able to see him on a regular basis.
How long had you actually been locked up at that point?
It was 22 months, almost 2 years.
And had you seen your son at all during that time?
My wife was bringing him about once a month at the initial part of the case. However, my wife was robbed 3 times coming to the prison to visit me. It's a very dangerous situation. She had to travel via bus, and so she just didn't feel safe bringing him. And oftentimes there was long lines outside the prison. She'd have to get there at 5 or 6 in the morning, and so it just wasn't conducive for an environment for my son.
And what's your sense now of what you can do? Do you think you'd ever go back to Nicaragua to try and pick up that business and start again? Or are you so suspect of the country that you wouldn't?
It's not that I'm suspect of the country. I still believe in the potential of Nicaragua, and I love the people and the place itself. It's more the fact that we still don't know why I was involved in this case. And so whoever is behind this, if it's just one person or a group of people, you know, I don't know what their motives were. And so it'd be really foolish of me to go back there thinking that they have resolved whatever issues that they had. And so I'm just in fear for my security as well as my family's security if I were to go back there. So, you know, obviously my wife's Nicaraguan. My son was born there. I spent a large part of my life there. So I definitely love the country. And I'd like to go back one day to show my son his heritage. But it'll be a while before I'm confident enough to do that.
You probably wouldn't be here if it wasn't for your sister Janice.
I'm absolutely positive I would not be here if it was not for Janice. and Jamie, my other sister, who oftentimes gets left out of our interviews. Right. Yeah.
And your mother, probably, to that extent, too.
Yes.
But it's, I mean, it's an interesting, does it change the dynamic between the two of you being back here now? You've always been close, right?
We've always been close, yeah. All three of us. So I think it has changed our dynamic a little bit.
Yeah.
Definitely, anytime you go through a hardship as such, it brings people closer.
Yeah. But, I mean, we had always kind of relied on each other, the three of us. We're a pretty tight-knit little group. But I think that now, you know, he knows I've got his back. I know he's got my back. It's cemented in stone for all eternity. So if anything, it's, you know, there's that bond was tested and was not broken.
You can read more about the story of Jason and Janice Perucal on our website. And we have links and videos and photos, all a part of our series, After Innocence, Exoneration in America. Coming up next on the program, one of the top men in the field of DNA says the science is getting more precise, but it's also increasingly open to abuse or misinterpretation. That's next. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story.
Support for The Story comes from Red Hat, an enterprise open source company that works within communities to create technology the open source way.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Most people have heard the news about Amanda Knox. She's the young American woman who, back in 2007, was arrested and accused of murdering her roommate in Italy. The case got a lot of attention because the coverage took on a kind of celebrity sensationalism.
I was in the courtroom when they were calling me a devil. I mean, it's one thing to be called certain things in the media, and then it's another thing to be sitting in a courtroom fighting for your life while people are calling you a devil. For all intents and purposes, I was a murderer, whether I was or not. And I had to live with the idea that that would be my life.
There's a twist to this story, because the Italian police used DNA to convict Amanda. She'd served 4 years before that DNA evidence was challenged. She was exonerated and allowed to return to the U.S. But how do you challenge DNA? Amanda's lawyers turned to one of the top experts in the U.S. to re-examine that DNA evidence. His name is Greg Hampikian, and he knew that there was something wrong when police in Italy singled out Amanda Knox and her then-boyfriend, Raphael.
So none of the DNA collected in the room where Meredith Kircher was killed, none of that DNA collected the day of the murder pointed to Amanda or Raphael. But the order was gut feeling, arrest, and then science. And eventually they did find DNA that supported the prosecution theory. They had a bra clip that was collected, I think, 46 days later. They went back to the room and found this piece of metal, the tiny bit of cloth, that had DNA claimed to be consistent with Raphael. And then at Raphael's apartment, they had a knife. And that on that knife, on the handle, was Amanda's DNA, Amanda Knox's DNA. She had been cooking there, so that's expected. But Meredith Kircher had not been in that apartment, the victim, and they said they found DNA consistent with her in a very, very small amount on the blade. And the question became, how did that DNA get there?
This is precisely Greg Hampikian's area of research. It's the new danger with DNA. Scientists can now zero in on such a minute sample that there's a danger that such incriminating evidence can be moved around in a forensic lab, quite by accident.
And we tried to follow some of the procedures we saw in the videotape collection of evidence where the CSI team did not change their gloves between every piece of evidence. So we changed our gloves between every other piece of evidence and saw that we got transfer of DNA. So going from a blood spot the size of a dime in the 1980s to get DNA to single molecules or 10 molecules of DNA, which is what we can do now typically, 20 molecules of DNA, that sensitivity has problems.
So what you're telling me is that the precision in the science, while giving you a finer microscope in, is actually creating new problems in terms of how you interpret that, right?
Yeah, and I think there are, it doesn't mean you throw all that evidence out, but you really have to retrain police officers in how to collect evidence properly for this level of sensitivity. Now, what many labs do is they just, frankly, don't look that low. They don't look at the 20 molecule level. They look more at 200 molecules or more. And my lab does something similar like that most of the time. When we go down to as far down as we can get, which is, 10 molecules maybe, we see contaminants in our chemicals. There are contaminants on the sterile gloves that we buy. Human DNA comes in on these sterile gloves. So you have to be very, very careful. And some labs can do that reliably. I'd say that my lab is not one of those labs, so I don't look down that far. That's one of the reasons I don't go that far. But basically, we try to keep a standard at about what the FBI uses.
I read somewhere that that there are scientists now calling for standards, ways of deciding how much DNA can play a role in a court case, or how far down the science would go. Is this something that you agree with now?
To me, the bigger problem is, we as scientists have enjoyed a reputation that is not deserved. We're treated as if we don't have all the normal human biases that people have. We hide behind the shield of science the way maybe the church did in the medieval ages. And the truth is that scientists are just as subject to normal human bias as anything else, to the influence of colleagues, to the influence of context. And Ithiel Dror and I published a paper where we took data, the same data, gave it to scientists in a crime lab, and asked them, is this suspect included in this DNA mixture or not? And those same scientists, working under the same guidelines, came up with all three possible answers. The person is included, the person is excluded, or it cannot be determined from this evidence. And that was from an actual case I had where I believe a man is innocent in prison in Georgia. It's working its way through the courts now, where I said that the analyst had made a mistake by saying this guy was included. 13 of the 17 analysts at this lab agreed with me. Only one of the scientists agreed with the original interpretation.
But I need to slow down for a
please,
minute because I have a real kind of grade school understanding of this science, but I thought it was cut and dried, like the DNA is there or it's not. And
when there's one contributor, it's very clear. I testified once about a game I played with my children with some evidence. And basically what we did was if you take Scrabble tiles, right, for your name and my name, you can see your name if we keep your Scrabble tiles next to you, and you can see my name. And now if we put them in a glass bowl in a mixture, like a mixture of DNA, you can suddenly pull out things like, Elizabeth Taylor and George Bush. And I did that with my children to show them the confounding problem of mixtures, and that's what I published on. Nobody gets wrong when there's a single donor to a DNA stain. Everybody can call that. I could teach probably a 10-year-old to do that. When it's a mixture, experts with 20 years experience will contradict one another. And it's well known in the field. It's not known. Juries don't realize this.
Right.
I think common people don't realize this, but we know that mixtures are very difficult to work with.
So what was it that got you involved in the Innocence Project?
I was at the University of Connecticut, and Henry Lee was one of the pioneers of using DNA. He was running the Connecticut State Crime Laboratory, and he came to see my advisor. I was in fruit flies. So he came to see my advisor, Dr. Linda Strauss-Bau, to consult about this new molecular DNA stuff. And I was teaching molecular techniques through a grant that I wrote. So I got involved early on in kind of this conversation of how these tools could be applied. And then I went on to Australia to work on marsupial sex determination. What is it on the Y chromosome that causes a mammal to grow testes and become a male?
Right.
You know, we all start out the same. Well, it turned out that that was an important forensic question, because the question was, can you take some spit from the floor and tell if it came from a man or a woman? Can you use those markers on the Y chromosome, which only males have, to identify the gender of a stain? And we knew that we could, so I consulted. That was back in the early 90s. And then Calvin Johnson Jr. got released from prison in Georgia, and I was teaching at Clayton State, now Clayton State University. And I heard him on the radio. I read about his story. I tacked it on my office wall on the inside because I wanted to meet him. I wanted to write about this.
Calvin Johnson Jr. was at that time exonerated?
He was exonerated. He was the 63rd, I think.
He'd been accused of rape. Is that right?
Yeah, accused and convicted of rape. There were two rapes, and everybody knew it was the same person who did it, same modus operandi. And he was convicted of the first one. He insisted on a trial for the second one, even though they could bring up that first rape. With the second trial, he was in Fulton County at a mixed-race jury, and they acquitted him. Same evidence, same witnesses. And he thought he would be released, but he spent 17 years in prison for that first rape and would have never gotten out had not Peter Neufeld and the Innocence Project taken his case. So when he's released through DNA, I just think this is incredible, and I want to write this book. I want to write something with Calvin. And so then I'm driving into work, and I used to listen to the Urban Station, try to keep track of what my students are listening to and quote from their songs because it made a connection. And Calvin Johnson's being interviewed on this station. And they ask him a really baited question. They say, after what happened to you, Mr. Johnson, what do you think of the criminal justice system now? And Calvin said, you got to have laws. And I thought, oh, my God, this guy, 17 years after, you know, being thrown into jail for something he didn't do, and he's talking about the importance of laws.
Embracing the justice.
Right. So I immediately called the woman in charge of booking speakers for the university. I said, if you don't bring him in, we're going to pay a fee. We're going to get him here.
Yeah.
And we brought him in, and I wrote chapter one of Exit to Freedom, which is his autobiography, there as he was speaking. I just wrote it and said, we're going to do this book. As I started working on that book, I started getting cases that I would work for free, and eventually I got good enough, and people said, well, you should take yourself seriously. You should be, you know, charging for these cases. So I charged a bit for the cases. And then, it's nice. It's nice to be paid for what you do. But suddenly I realized that that I finally had what I wanted. I had something really important, you know, a gift that I could give somebody that very few people could give them, right? And that might lead to their freedom. So, you know, rather than always charging an hourly rate, I started taking these cases on purpose for free where people had just no hope at all. And at first it was just really fun and exciting. And then it became a huge responsibility. And, I mean, there are people here you can talk to, moms and dads. The moms and dads come to these conferences, tell us about their kids in prison, or they call me, they find me. And, I mean, there's four or five moms now who call me weekly that we still talk, cases I've worked on for 10 years. So it's not just fun and excitement and science. It's dealing with moms and dads who are getting older and older, trying to get their innocent children out of prison. And that's devastating.
I mean, we always hear about that remarkable discovery that frees someone from jail after 15 or 24 years behind bars. How often does it happen, Greg, that you apply the latest technique and all the science you can to a case like that, and you have to turn around and say, it's not here. DNA is not going to help your case.
most times there's nothing I can do, right? So that's part of the part of this job. It's very tough. And the problem is it takes time to find out that there's nothing I can do. I mean, it takes time to go through a file, to try to see evidence, to see if there's something we can do, to try to keep track of the latest science, and then have to revisit all the cases as soon as there's something new, like touch DNA. Suddenly we don't have to find stains anymore. We can scrape clothing. And so I have to go back to all those cases and see the ones I rejected. Can we apply these things? So there's a lot of wasted or spent time, I would say, that leads to nothing substantial. It's just a lot of work, a lot of slogging. And the exonerations are, you know, a tip of the iceberg. There are so many cases we can't do anything on that to me the exonerations are almost symbolic. What they should show us is what's wrong with the system, and we should take that lesson and then revisit the thousands of cases that where there is no DNA, where the same either bad forensic science put people in prison like bite marks, or where there was a prisoner who testified against them in exchange for a reduced sentence. We should revisit all of the cases where that prisoner testified wrongly against someone who's been exonerated. I mean, the problem is we're not applying the lessons from these very few symbolic exonerations. They're here to teach us a lesson. And we're trying to do that. I think the Innocence Network is really trying to help law enforcement, which wants to catch the right guy. And we're just all trying to learn.
Let me ask you something, though. Here we are in 2013, and we're looking at court cases from 20 years ago when the DNA science was much more in its infancy or not being applied at all. And so you get to go back and maybe you'll have some biological evidence from an assault or a rape that will lead to someone's exoneration. But 20 years from now, will the DNA be as important in looking back? I mean, I would like to believe that the prosecution and the defense is using DNA to its advantage right now in convicting people or in setting them free. So will we be looking back as much in the years ahead?
Yeah, because every solution brings new problems. It's kind of like medicine that has side effects. So, for example, DNA is being used a lot now, but we have a lot of these mixture cases. Mm-hmm. I think there are mistakes being made. So people are being convicted sometimes. These are rare occasions, but
Based on bad
DNA interpretation. And I mean, that's why we did our study. That's why we published our paper, to show that, you know what? Yes, DNA is great. It allows us to really learn things we couldn't learn before, but it can be misused. It can be misinterpreted. There is bias. There's bad testimony. There is lab practices that cause contamination. And in fact, I've spent 12 years on an invention so that when you give a swab to the police, you can put this stuff in there and it will always mark it as a known sample, a reference sample, so they can't spill it on a knife, say, and suddenly you're part of a investigation. And that's happened.
We have planted DNA accidentally
in the lab. Now, when we take your molecules in the lab, we amplify them. That means we copy every single molecule you give us. We copy about a billion times. So we have a tube that's just so enriched for your DNA and tools so sensitive that if we spill a few molecules, years later it can be detected on something.
That's
on
scary.
Yeah, and it's happened. There's no doubt that we have cases where it's been a victim of a rape who gets whose DNA turns up on a crime associated with a weapon years later. Or a dead child years later. And this is a victim from a rape. So obviously the DNA was transferred. There are tubes that have been mislabeled. Las Vegas, a famous case just recently, they just mixed up the tubes, put the wrong man in prison. They told this man there's DNA against you. So he made a deal. He knew the DNA was so powerful. Well, years later, through the help of the California laboratory system that detected this mistake, this man was freed from Las Vegas. So with every medicine, there are side effects. I don't think we'll ever go out of business at the Innocence Network. There's plenty of stuff to do. There's 2.4 million people in the United States behind bars. So even if it's 1%, let's say,
I know,
wrong,
that's a frightening 24,000, statistic, isn't it?
It'll keep us busy.
That's Greg Hampikian. He's a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Boise State University, and he's also director of the Idaho Innocence Project.
Support for the series After Innocence, Exoneration in America comes from the Park Foundation, the Fetzer Institute, and the Paul Green Foundation.
Support comes from the Redwoods Group Foundation, collaborating with Darkness to Light and local YMCAs to prevent child sexual abuse in America. D2L.org. And Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. A broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And this is APM, American Public Media.